So the kind of subject matter that I'd really like to go into over these 2 days really falls under the heading of what is in Pali the paramis. This is a word that many of you will be familiar with. It is a grouping or a cluster of qualities of heart and mind. Now, before I go into it, there's just something I'd like to just comment on briefly, is that I think in Western Dharma practice, the way that many people have come to engage with the Dharma is often in more formal meditation practice environments. So often when I hear people speaking about their engagement with this teaching, the word practice is often what is used. You know, my practice, our practice, this practice. And which is absolutely fine. There's nothing wrong with saying that. But I think what is very, very important to acknowledge, of course, is that the Buddha did not just teach formal meditation practice. The Buddha very much emphasized path. In fact, the word practice doesn't even exist in Pali. So he very much used the word path. And the Pali word for, of course, the cultivation or the walking on this path is again a word some of you will be familiar with, which is bhavana. And bhavana translates into English as to cultivate. To cultivate. Bearing in mind that in the time of the Buddha, India at that time was very much an agrarian society. So very much, very many of the words that the Buddha used, the metaphors that the Buddha used, really refer, are rooted in this agrarian society. So the path was very much referred to as bhavana, what is cultivated, what is brought into being. Now, I think this is, I don't want to belabor this too much, but very often one approach to the path is focusing very much upon, what is being let go of, and very much hear this, I need to let go of greed, hatred, and delusion, I need to let go of my story, I need to let go of the hindrances, There's an awful lot that seems to need to be let go of. But this is only one side, of course, of the picture. And very much the Buddha didn't speak about necessarily approaching this path as this kind of chipping away at the coal face of letting go of, but very much spoke about the cultivation of the wholesome and the skillful and the ennobling, and that cultivation actually being the mechanisms of renunciation. Actually being the means of renunciation. So letting go was not presented as this effortful personal responsibility that I need to let go, but rather through the cultivation of the wholesome, the skillful, the liberating, the ennobling, the unskillful or the unwholesome is actually being released. So it's just a slight kind of reframing of reference, which I personally feel is actually quite important, as I hear many people in the West almost approaching, equating practice with work. What I'm working on. This retreat I'm working on my anger, then I'm working on my greed, then I'm working on this. And it all starts to be this very personal effort for responsibility rather than what is being cultivated, what is being cultivated. And in this, of course, the Buddha very much widened the frame of reference, speaking not just about what happened on a cushion or in a walking path, but the cultivation of an awakened life, which of course includes every aspect of our lives as being the ground of cultivation. This is, I think, so significant. Because if we don't have that kind of wider frame of reference, it's all too easy to feel like, you know, I just need to put in my time on my cushion, then I got to go off and live my life, as if it has nothing necessarily directly to do with that. But of course, this whole path of cultivation includes that much wider frame of reference of where are we cultivating an awakened life and where is an unawakened life being cultivated. So I want to carry on just a little bit from what I was speaking about last night, because what we see throughout the teachings is this peppering of the teaching with what the Buddha called the Dhamma Chanda, the Kusala Chanda, or even the Arya Chanda, which is referring to this dimension of cultivation or this dimension of desire that is central to the path of awakening. Now that dimension, this Dhamma Chanda includes all of our aspirations for peace, for kindness, for compassion, for authenticity, for awakening. So this desire to understand what is true, what is liberating, and to embody those aspirations in our lives is actually the beginning of the path. So the path begins with this place of aspiration. This begins with this place of the longing for awakening. Now, again, when you look at the early discourses in the Pali Canon, we see again, this encouragement to cultivate an ennobled life, a noble life. Integrity, dignity, compassion, insight. And to cultivate the qualities of heart, the qualities of mind that ennoble our lives, our relationships with others, with the world, with ourselves. Now, throughout the teachings, and many of you will know this, how much the Dhamma is a teaching of lists. You know, this teaching is very good at lists, which actually was actually a very kind of expedient means, a skillful means at the time. You know, bearing in mind that this was an oral tradition for a very, very long time, the way that actually the teaching was remembered or organized was to put it into these series of lists. You know, so it was a kind of an organization of this oral teaching. So these lists of these ennobling qualities, you know, there are a number of them. We see them in the Brahmaviharas, the divine abidings, of kindness, of compassion, of appreciative joy, of equanimity. We see the lists of the ennobling qualities in the factors of awakening, in the teachings of integrity. So these ennobling qualities are often referred to in the teaching as the treasures of the heart. So one of those lists that I want to focus on over these days is what is called in Pali the Paramis, or in Sanskrit the Paramita. The usual translation of this is the perfections, which is kind of a scary word. The 10 or the 6 perfections. But what these Paramis are describing in reality is the landscape of an awakened heart. If you want to look at what does the mind of a Buddha look like? What does the heart of a Buddha look like? Of an awakened being look like? The Paramis are describing this landscape of awakening, and certainly in the Mahayana tradition, this collection of these ennobling qualities are essentially described as being the very fabric of compassion. That compassion is not just an emotion or a response, but the compassion is very much the fruition of these qualities that are developed and brought to maturity. Now, as in all the lists and in all the ennobling qualities that the Buddha speaks about, there are two aspects to all of these qualities. One aspect is actually is the path, the bhavana, the cultivation, the bringing into being, the nurturing. In Pali, the word for this is magga, this cultivation of the path. And then the other aspect of these qualities is what is called in Pali, pala, which is the fruition, the maturity. So we see this, these qualities are cultivated, and through their cultivation, through their application, increasingly these qualities of the paramis are brought to fruition in a way they become naturalized. They become into the bones. They become the kind of most authentic, unhesitating response. And they become unshakable. This is what fruition really speaks about. These qualities become unshakable as part of the landscape of an awakened mind. Now, when you look at the early texts, the Buddha speaks about the paramis, these qualities, over and over again. And yet, in the early texts, the actual collation of these qualities into a list does not exist. It doesn't exist in the early Pali Canon, which we would consider as much as we can to be the most authentic teachings of the Buddha. It's clear that in the early days as the teachings that the paramis were considered to be essential elements of the path, but they weren't organized in the lists that we're more familiar with. The organization of the paramis into a list came much later in the Mahayana teaching, where the early list of the paramis as being 10 was brought down to being 6. And I will go through these, by the way, so I don't feel like I'm just... But the clearest teaching of the paramis organized into a list as a path really comes with the advent of Shantideva in the Bodhisattva's guide to the way to the Bodhisattva, guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life. So this comes much, much later. So there is, and this is just give to a little background, by the way, to what I'm going to talk about. There is, in earlier on, around the time of Buddhaghosa, which came around 1,000 years after the Buddha's death, he had a compatriot called Dhammapala, who gave a certain kind of discourse on the paramis, where he says, through their wisdom, the bodhisattva perfects within themselves the character of a Buddha. Through their compassion, the ability to perform the work of a Buddha. Through wisdom, she brings herself across the stream of becoming, breaking out of the cycles of samsara. Through compassion, he leads others across. Through compassion, she trembles with empathy for all. But because her compassion is accompanied by wisdom, their heart is unattached. So it is in these early commentaries that there is the bringing together of these qualities, this fabric of compassion, into the landscape of insight to bring this kind of unbreakable, essential union between insight and compassion, which is said to be enabled through the paramis, the cultivation of the perfections. So everybody, with me so far. So that's the background. So in the early discourses, you see the paramis listed as being 10. Generosity, integrity, renunciation, insight, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, boundless friendliness, and equanimity. By the way, this is all recorded and available later, so you don't have to worry about sort of getting this all down on paper. In the Mahayana tradition, the paramis came into a list of generosity, virtue, patience, energy, concentration, and insight. This weekend I'm going to work with the list of the 10, hopefully, and if I don't finish next year, we will complete this. Feels an ambitious task. So I want to start with this first of the perfections, the first of the paramis, which is generosity. Now, certainly in the Buddha's teaching, generosity is really felt to be the foundational quality, the most ennobling quality of heart that lies at the path of awakening. This is the first step. It's the first step. It provides the climate, it provides the background for the entire path to develop. Now, I think often in the West, we're much more familiar with hearing about this threefold path of development as ethics, sila, samadhi, panya. Many of you will be familiar with this. Ethics, samadhi, describing the whole of the meditative development, and panya, wisdom. But in reality, the path actually is a fourfold path, which begins with generosity or dana. In the bodhisattva path, and I will be referring a lot to the bodhisattva path over this weekend and to some of the work of Shantideva, because this is where the paramis are most expounded. Is everybody familiar with the word bodhisattva, by the way? Is anybody not familiar with the word bodhisattva? Don't be embarrassed, please. So the bodhisattva path is certainly in the early text, and it certainly very much features most strongly in the Mahayana text as being the path of cultivating an aspiration on the path to liberate all beings from the world of suffering and cycles of samsara. So in the bodhisattva path, the cultivation of boundless compassion, generosity is also the essential beginning. Now, what I think is really important to understand in the way in which this path is described is that these are not separate developments. You know, we don't develop generosity and then somewhere else we develop sila or ethics, and then maybe over here we develop some meditation, you know, and maybe if we're fortunate, a little bit of insight springs forth. I mean, these are meant to be all interwoven threads of one fabric. So it is like virtue or ethics leans upon generosity. You know, generosity leans upon insight. Meditative development really relies upon the climate of integrity and generosity. So they are all leaning upon one another. So we cannot pick and choose here, essentially. If we want to bring the path to fruition, we can't just decide, well, you know, I think I'll do a little meditation over here, but, you know, integrity doesn't really matter. You know, or you know, I'm all going for insight, but, you know, I think, you know, I'm not really that interested in generosity. So they are meant really to all lean upon one another and support one another. They are these four foundations of generosity, ethics, meditative development, insight are actually often described as being four limbs of one body. The four limbs of one body. Now, if you go to Asia today, or if you've gone to Asia in the past, you do get a sense in many ways about how dana, or generosity, has come to be regarded as something of a devotional practice. It is a way of supporting the monastic structure. So, you know, there's a great enthusiasm and dedication to the lay community, you know, to offer to the monasteries, to support the monasteries. In the West, we, of course, have spent the last 40 years, actually, endeavoring to bring about some education about what dana or generosity means. But again, it's easy in the West not to think about dana so much as a devotional practice, but only as a material contribution. But it is important to appreciate that the material generosity in the West and in Asia is what has allowed the flowering of the Dharma in our culture. And, you know, that's pretty awesome. That really is pretty awesome. Every center I teach in, you know, and I teach in many centers, personally I'm constantly sort of so touched and moved by the fact that this has all happened through generosity. Yet dana, generosity, and please, can you familiarize this word, dana? Dana. I don't have to keep translating it. So, in my understanding, dana is meant to be something much more profound than either a devotional practice or simply material. It is part of the cultivation of the heart. It is an insight practice. Dana is an insight practice. I think it's so important to integrate that reality. Because what is dana really about? Dana is a teaching that is intended to challenge any sense of possessiveness. Any sense of possessiveness. This is what dana is really concerned with. Which is, and to challenge any sense of possessiveness is equally to challenge all ideas of self and ownership. Makes it a little more weighty, doesn't it? Than putting some money in a basket. This is a little bit more weighty, to challenge all sense of self and ownership, which is equally to challenge all ideas of I and you. To challenge, to question the reality of that. As such, the cultivation of generosity is an investigation into every area of our life where a sense of ownership prevails. Sit with that one for a moment. My body, my time, my emotions, my possessions, my space, my opinions, my conclusions, my judgments. Look at the places where a sense of ownership of I and mine prevails. Isn't it true that these are the places where we suffer? That are the most fertile ground for suffering to arise. These are the places, the sense of where ownership prevails, where fear, obsession, ill will, and separation flourish. In truth, I think, and I would encourage you just to question that, is there any emotional, psychological affliction we can experience that cannot be traced to that sense of possessiveness? Of I and mine, you and yours. Has anybody got any that exist outside of that sphere? So what dana is really about, this cultivation of generosity is really about, is to look at every place in our lives where the thought or the underlying sense of this is me, this belongs to me, this is mine, this is who I am. To look at every place in our lives where that underlying sense may exist, because this is where dana is cultivated. This is where generosity is cultivated. And the generosity that is cultivated in the real teaching of dana is not holding anywhere, not clinging anywhere, not owning, not extending a sense of ownership upon anything. Into all those areas where that sense of I and my prevails, there is brought the question, is this actually true? Is this mine? Does this belong to me? Is this who I am? So this dana then, as an insight practice, is really a path of investigation, as insight practice is. It's not a path of judgment or blame. It is a path of investigation, of inquiry. And what is that investigation in the service of? It is really in the service of liberating our hearts, of bringing about an end of division and freeing us of the contractedness and imprisonment of a world defined by a separate self. Is everybody okay with this? So generosity as a cultivation and as a path is a cultivation that ties in very directly into the primary insights of the Buddha's teaching, or the primary contemplations of the Buddha's teaching. So generosity is tying very much into the contemplation of anicca, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness or dukkha, the chronic misalignment with the way things actually are, and anatta, non-self or no independent self-existence. There is a direct link between the cultivation and the fruition of generosity and the understanding of the three characteristics. And I just want to go into that a little bit. Now, all sense, certainly in my experience, maybe it's different in yours, but in my experience, all sense of possessiveness and ownership, I, mine, belonging to me, manifests very directly, or is experienced very directly in clinging. You notice that? Experience that is its manifestation. It gets very experienced very directly in holding and in identification. You know, if we just reflect on anything that we might be able to sort of put our finger on in our lives right now, where that sense of ownership prevails, we see its manifestation in terms of clinging. Now, in truth, if we look at the reality of the three characteristics, the reality of impermanence, which I'm sure we all agree with, at least intellectually, the reality of impermanence, doesn't it just make a mockery of clinging? Doesn't it just make clinging nonsensical? I mean, if you stand outside of anything that we're particularly identified with or cling to as me or mine, and then put alongside it the reality that nothing in this world stands still, doesn't the reality of impermanence actually make a mockery out of clinging, all notions of mine or belonging to me? We know, certainly, you know, and we certainly know, at least intellectually, that we live in a world where our feet are set on shifting sands. We know, at least intellectually, that we cannot truly hold on to anything. Does it stop us trying? Often not. We try, and then we suffer. We try, and then we end up tormented. So that's a Nietzsche in relationship to the investigation of Dana. Dukkha. Dukkha tells us that all things in life, everything we can see, hear, feel, touch, experience, is subject to conditions. Everything. Conditions are unstable. What is ownership? Possessiveness trying to do? It's an endeavor to make the unstable stable. And then we suffer because of the endless disappointment where the world simply doesn't stand still for us. The world won't stand still for us. Anatta, the understanding of non-self. The Buddha encouraged us to bring that reflection and that investigation into all, where? Into all the moments of clinging. Not to investigate non-self as some abstract theory, but to bring that investigation into all the moments of clinging, of holding. And you see in the early texts this encouragement of the Buddha, in all those moments of clinging, take some moments just to bring the question as an open possibility that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am, this does not belong to me. It's a teaching of not holding anywhere. It is a teaching of generosity. Anatta is a teaching of generosity in a very real way. It's because it's a teaching of freedom. Is everybody okay? No? Now, like, I don't want to then make generosity as this seemed to be this impossible attainment. Because like all of the ennobling qualities of heart we can experience, generosity is a practice and it is a path. And it builds upon something we already know. You know, personally, I find this to be the great genius of the Buddha. Is that he doesn't talk about esoteric experiences or possibilities that none of us can even imagine. The great genius of the Buddha was always to build upon what we already on some level know or on some level have tasted, no matter how briefly. Because we have all known and all do know moments in our life when we step out of the narrow confines of the world of self and touch the loveliness of generosity. We have perhaps all known or been touched by moments of genuine generosity from others. But we have all tasted this probably in our lives when we see someone struggling and unhesitatingly reach out to help. Not passing through the filters of is this worthy, you know, should I or shouldn't I? Just, yes, it is a moment of generosity. We have perhaps tasted the moments of the freedom that comes when we're suddenly, sometimes unexpectedly, able to step out of the world of contractedness and judgments. These moments don't have to be accidents. And this is really, I think, the whole gift of this path, is the Buddha is taking many of the loveliness of these moments when we've touched upon the paramis. He's taking them out of the world of just these mysterious accidental encounters and saying, you know, these are seeds that lie within our hearts, seeds of understanding, seeds of loveliness that are asking to be cultivated and brought into being, bhavana. Now, bearing in mind what I said earlier, that Dana is the first of the building blocks of the path of compassion and the path of awakening. Now, when the Dalai Lama has spoken about generosity and compassion, he's referred to it as being the radicalism of our time. And I often, think about that. What does that mean for Dana, for all of the paramis? But say just this one parami of generosity. Why would that be the radicalism of our time? Basically, because it's about swimming against the tide. It's basically about swimming against the tide of holding, of possessiveness, of I, me, mine, you, yours. It's swimming against the tide of separation, against the tide of fear, against the tide of withholding and contractedness that so besets our world. Now, this is a piece that I want to go on to now, because much of this teaching and this path is not about what we feel. It's about what we do. That's part of why this is the radicalism of our time. Not about what we feel, but about what we do, what we commit ourselves to. We don't have to feel generous to be generous. It's interesting, isn't it? That's very countercultural. We don't have to feel generous to be generous. I mean, if you look at, what is the definition of karma? Action. It's about what we do. It's about what we commit ourselves to in our lives. So it challenges, I think, not only in our culture, but in other cultures, doing generosity, enacting generosity, living generously. Challenges, I think, particularly in our culture, one of our primary holdings where we believe that our actions and our choices are only right if we feel like it. Now, look at the times when we're withholding, where that sense of possessiveness or ownership or withholding, contractedness comes about. When we're withholding of our time, our attention, our space, our kindness, we don't feel generous in those times. And we don't feel generous. So what's going on in those times? What is going on in those times? Where are we making our home? Now, if I gave a sort of a different analogy for this, many of you I know have been on retreats and know that retreats are, fairly disciplined environments. Imagine what would it be like on a retreat if you heard from the front of the room, "Please only come and sit if you really feel like it." "Please only do a walking meditation if you really, really feel like it." I don't think anybody's ever heard that message. I mean, it's not like we take registration or anything like that. But there is something that's going on in retreats which is actually swimming against the tide of what we feel like. If we gave that message, we'd probably have a lot of empty cushions and a lot of full beds. No, but we do come, and it's very interesting, because I never, ever say when I'm teaching retreat, "I expect to see you at every sitting," or "I expect to see you in every walking period." Actually, we don't need to say that. I never need to say that. I'm often rather surprised, actually. People come. They come and they sit. They go and they walk. Why? Because there is something deeper more enduring and more wholesome in the intentionality that is present and being committed to than what is actually being felt like in the moment. So people bring themselves because that sense of intentionality and commitment is at the forefront of their mind and holding more sway than what I particularly feel like in the moment. So again, the practice, the path, is something that we do rather than just what we feel like. Think about how this then extrapolates out into the paramis and into the rest of these cultivations. So what is happening in this radicalism of our time that is really speaking about what we are committed to, what we most deeply value and honor as being worthy and liberating? It is the radicalism of our time because it is actually stretching us beyond what we describe as being our comfort zone. And it's so strange to me that what we describe as being our comfort zone is actually the zone of familiarity of I, me, what belongs to me, what is mine. It's really uncomfortable, actually, our comfort zone. There's only a superficial level of comfort, isn't it? I mean, underneath there is, of course, the whole fear of something being lost, something being intruded upon, something being taken away from us, something to defend, something to protect. Our comfort zone is one of the most uncomfortable places to live in this entire world, isn't it? And that's kind of turning that illusion on its head, isn't it? It's really questioning that and the willingness to be disturbed. You know, by reflecting on this practice as something we do, it is actually undertaking inwardly, not from any external authority, but undertaking inwardly that willingness to be disturbed and see whether our comfort zone is actually a comfort zone or whether the true comfort zone is actually in the liberation of our hearts and not in the control of our world. So I want to read you something from one of the earlier discourses in the Buddha's teaching on dana, on generosity. What is the accomplishment of generosity? Here a noble disciple dwells at home with a mind free from the stain of ownership, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment. Delighting in relinquishment, devoted to giving and sharing. This is called the accomplishment of generosity. A noble disciple recollects their own generosity thus. It is a gain for me. It is a well gained by me. That in a generation obsessed by the stain of ownership, I dwell at home with a heart devoid from the stain of ownership, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, devoted to giving and sharing. When a noble disciple recollects their own generosity thus, on that occasion their mind is not obsessed by greed, hatred, and delusion. Their mind is straight with generosity as its object. The effect of generosity. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains the inspiration of the meaning, the inspiration of the Dharma, gains gladness connected with the Dharma. When they are gladdened, rapture arises. For one uplifted by rapture, the body becomes calm. One calm in body feels happy. For one who is happy, the mind becomes concentrated. This is called a noble disciple who dwells evenly amidst an uneven generation, who dwells unafflicted amidst an afflicted generation, who has entered the stream of the Dharma and develops recollection of generosity. Clearly, in this discourse, I hope you see the way that the Buddha is really relating this whole cultivation of dana as an insight practice, as a forerunner to meditation, but more also speaking, I think so importantly, the happiness of generosity, the happiness, the joy of relinquishment. None of this sort of over-earnest, you know, what do I give today? You know, the joy of being free of that sense of ownership of me and mine amidst a generation afflicted by ownership and me and mine. Then goes on to speak about 8 ways of cultivating generosity. A person gives spontaneously. These are not all great ways, by the way. A person gives from fear. A person gives thinking, well, they gave me something. A person gives thinking, they might give me something. A person gives thinking, well, it's good to give. And a person gives thinking, well, I'm cooking something, they are not. It would not be right not to give something to those who are not cooking. A person gives thinking, if I make this gift, I shall acquire a good reputation. And a person gives because it ennobles and adorns the mind. I'm wondering if this is a good moment to pause. Have you sated for a moment, or do you want to take another 10 minutes? You good with another 10 minutes? So I want to look at another dimension of dana, another dimension of generosity. Because I think in its deepest sense, generosity as being a radical change of heart, it's really speaking of a heart and mind deeply established in courage, in fearlessness, in kindness, and in insight. So it's bearing in mind, remember as I talked earlier how dana and integrity and insight and meditation practice are all interwoven. In many ways, it takes a lot of insight to actually cultivate generosity. It's not that generosity is just the beginning. It takes a lot of insight, but it also takes fearlessness. Heart established in that kind of understanding and fearlessness understands the freedom of learning to let go and to release in all the places of clinging. Now, generosity is really born of deeply understanding in our own experience, knowing it, the pain and the sorrow of the contracted and fearful heart. The pain and the sorrow of a heart and a mind that spins around the centrality of I, me, mine, belongs to me. Because that centrality of ownership is really a centrality of fear and a centrality of a belief, as I mentioned last night, in insufficiency. I am made something by what I have. I am made something by holding to my opinions, my space, my time, my identity. I am made something by that holding, rooted in this sense that without that, I am nothing. Generosity is really about deeply, deeply questioning. You know, generosity, I think, in its deepest sense, is born of deeply questioning this core belief of insufficiency. You know, and we see this in so many of the Dharma stories, don't we? When my house burned down, I gained an unobstructed view of the moonlit sky. Living in my house, I don't have that view. So generosity as a practice is really teaching us to turn away, not from the world, not from relatedness, but teaching us to turn away from the isolation and endless craving that fear brings. To turn towards relatedness and trust, to see the sorrow of self-cherishing, and to see the joy and the happiness of being deeply aligned with the way things are. Anicca, dukkha, anatta. Change and stability of conditions, non-self. It's not even about being generous with ourselves or generous with others. It is about being generous. It is about cultivating generosity. As Shantideva, one of the great poets of compassion, put it, to neglect oneself to care for others is not compassion. To care for oneself and neglect others is not compassion. Anybody have anything they question or anything they want to raise? Yeah. Can you hear the question?
No.
So the question is that if you take the investigation of generosity very deeply, that the whole of the path seems to be contained within it. I think this is true. but I think the same can be said almost of any of the paramis, that if you unpack it more and more, you find that everything draws into it. It's almost as if, because I think you'll find this as I go through the different paramis, it's almost like, you could take this as a practice, for a year or for a lifetime, but say you commit to it for a period of time. I think spending that amount of time with it is really, really helpful because you begin to go through the different layers of it. And that's why it's worth having the kind of depth and not just the breadth. But I also feel like temperamentally, perhaps different people can relate to different ones of the paramis more directly. For one person it might be generosity, for another person it might be patience or energy. They might find in their own temperament, oh, this is a place where I get really sticky. And if they go into that parami where they feel this kind of very clear sense of relatedness to it, that could differ from person to person, which is great because we've got 10. And that's bound to have something to say to pretty much everybody, Yeah.
In that list of 8 unskillful generosity...
Oh, mixed. Not entirely unskillful, but mixed.
Was there a mention there? It seems to me that there's a potential for unskillful generosity, particularly with one's children, where the tug is to give. And sometimes giving without strings is not a very generous thing to do.
Okay. Could you hear the question?
Yes.
There's 2 dimensions to that particular example, and I think those 2 dimensions exist in many situations in our life. Is it particularly skillful, for example, to give money to someone who's going to go directly to the liquor store? Is it skillful with children always to say yes? Now, is that actually generosity to give without wise discernment? Or are there other things going on there, afraid of children being alienated from us or afraid of the anger of someone if we don't give? So I think we need to see that there's 2 dimensions of generosity. The first dimension that is being spoken of is actually about the attitude of heart and mind. Whether there is an attitude of generosity or whether there is an attitude of contractedness and withholding that is built around fear. So that's the first piece for us to take care of, is to be mindful of our own attitude of mind, our own intentionality, our own clarity and understanding. The second dimension is then how that manifests in the world. Okay, and these two are not exactly the same, because in the terms of the parami of generosity is really speaking most directly to this inner attitude, mental state, belief system that is behind generosity or ownership. The second dimension of generosity, which is how it's embodied in the world, has more to do with wise action and wise discernment. Okay? So they're actually kind of like, they're not disconnected, but they're not one and the same thing. Yeah.
So does that imply that there may be times when it's wise discernment to hold on to something that is yours?
Well, it mustn't translate the teaching of generosity as this sort of, you know, just, you know, retire to a cave and give everything away. That can almost fall within this list of unskillful. I do this because I should, or because it gives me a good reputation, or because it looks good. It's nothing to do with that. It's again in this inner attitude. Now, in that. You know, I live in a house. Most of us live in a house. We don't live in a cave, you know. But how much do I have associated, say, around that particular example? Because it's the same things I will have associated around my opinions, around my views, my body. It's not going to be different, whether it's to do with my home or whether it's to do with my opinions. How much around that is that surrounded by fear, by this is mine, this is makes me who I am, and how much of it is simply the place where I live and take care of. You know, and it's not going to be different in any area of our lives. It's not like I'm going to be, you know, have a great sense of ownership around my house and not about my views. Because it's to do with the sense of selfing that gets established in these areas of our lives that we regard as me and mine and belonging to me. Yeah.
Just hoping you might clarify the difference. What I heard you say was it doesn't matter how you feel about being generous. But also that seems a little counter to other teachings I've heard where they talk about the intention of being behind being generous. That you could do it an act of generosity, but if the intention isn't wholesome.
Well, this is a. Did you hear the questions? Bringing up, you know, the place that I raised about that it doesn't matter how you feel, it's about what you do, which in some ways seems contradictory to other elements of the teaching where it talks about, you know, having clear intention and then seeing what springs from that. I don't actually think they're all actually so separate, you know, because intention is not about how we feel. Intention is about what we commit to, you know, and if you look at what in intention is how the Buddha talked about, he just talked about three, you know, kindness, compassion, and renunciation, which includes generosity. So he actually talks about, you know, the commitment to those intentions rather than, again, how we feel. Now, what's I think really important to just kind of reflect on or examine, and I reflect on this a lot for myself. You know, when we look at the Eightfold Path, which many of you will be familiar with, which is actually the path to liberation, what we cultivate, what we embody. The first step in the Eightfold Path is wise view, wise understanding. Everything else follows on from wise view. You know, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise practice, wise effort, all the rest of it. Now, think about it. If we waited till we had perfectly wise view before any of the other rest of the path could be cultivated, that feels like a stopper, doesn't it? But what we have to see is like the rest of the path is meant to feed back into wise view. So every time, for example, that we commit ourselves to practicing wise speech, it is clarifying wrong view. and it's cultivating wise for you. Now, it's a little bit the same with the practice of generosity not being about what we feel, but about what we do. Every time we determine, make the intention, not to make our home in ownership, but in non-withholding, that's going to come back to just slightly ease that grip of ownership and withholding. So it's almost as if the action is feeding back into the view. So I don't actually think it's so separate, because, you know, intentionality certainly in this teaching gets really, really core, and it is about commitment again rather than what we feel like. It's a really curious one, I think, and I find that really challenging personally, you know, that what I feel like may not be the most important thing. That's sort of interesting to me. Because it's always about what I feel like. It's not about what feeling might be most beneficial for myself and all beings. It's about what I feel like. It's such an interesting dimension for me to reflect on. Yeah. I never. No, that I'm saying that very, it's a real generalization. I mean, put it this way, do I trust every thought that I have? No. You know, do I trust every feeling I have? Why would I trust what I feel like more than I would trust what I think? You know, I don't think it's about not trusting. I don't think it's about not trusting. It's not about being dismissive or not trusting. But I think it's actually being willing to investigate. You know, when I don't feel this way, what's actually going on here? Rather than just assuming that what I feel like in that moment is a kind of wise response to what is. So it's actually about investigating. I mean, when that, you know, and that's what I talked about, you know, because we have the many spontaneous moments of generosity, of kindness and compassion. We don't really have to investigate those so much more than we have to really honor the loveliness of those moments. Because I think that there's a sense of really a kind of authenticity in those moments. But what the Buddha is really talking about is not allowing them to be accidents. So in the times when I don't feel generous, those are more the invitational moments to look, what is operating here? How much is there a sense of fear, of ownership, of possessiveness, of contractedness operating in those moments? So it's not trusting or not trusting. It's being willing to question. And it's like, you know, the Dalai Lama once said, you know, that I can't pretend to be compassionate all the time. But I know it to be the most noble intention of a human being and the highest aspiration. So this, I think, applies to all of the paramis. You know, we know generosity is a noble, an ennobling quality and a noble intention that is benefit to all. So we know that, and we can't pretend that we always feel generous. But in knowing it to be, having confidence in it being a liberating quality, then we question the times when it doesn't feel so present. Okay, shall we move on a little bit, seeing as we're still on the first parami? So here, in this next little small piece, because I don't have so much more on this, I want to go back to some of the work of Shantideva, where he speaks about generosity in the path of compassion in three ways. Speaks about the first way of material generosity, which includes, in my understanding, areas such as time, attention. speaks about the gift of the generosity, the gift of fearlessness. And the third dimension of generosity speaks about is the gift of the Dhamma, or the gift of the path, the gift of truthfulness. So I want to just look briefly at these three areas. Now, the Buddha was very clear in saying that a disciple of liberation is not possessive of anything. And here I want to come back to a theme that I've been touching on, this theme of insufficiency, you know, the empty hole, the not enough feeling that can really permeate much of our experience, you know, not having enough, not being enough, that exists very much, it's very much built into the idea of self. I mean, the sense of self lives in this belief system of insufficiency, of not enough. Now, a distinction that is very important to make here, and I'm sure you've all thought about it, you know, there is a reality in the world where people do not have enough. You know, that is a simple reality that governs many people's lives, that they simply do not have enough food or shelter or safety or love or any of these things. So that is a kind of a reality we acknowledge. So when I'm speaking about the belief in insufficiency, it's not about going to somebody on the street and saying, you know, really, you have enough. You know, what I'm really speaking about here is actually this more psychological, emotional belief system that can exist in a person who has everything or much, or can exist in someone who has very little. But I'm really talking about an emotional and a psychological climate and belief system that revolves around a sense of fear and a sense of selfing. Because this belief in insufficiency is what craving and possessiveness is built upon. Unfortunately, it doesn't ease it. You know, the sense of insufficiency generates craving, generates a possessiveness, the desire for ownership, but actually strengthens it. And what is really spoken about in generosity is, what does it mean to take the selfing out of all of the things that we are fortunate to have in this life? But what does it mean to take the selfing out of my body, my mind, my views, my conclusions, my judgment? And it is, and I want to refer back to what I read earlier, how the Buddha speaks about the joy of that, the joy of relinquishment, not a punishment, but as a gift of compassion, as a gift of care, as a gift of love, because that is what is actually taking the suffering out. Certainly one of my first teachers really spoke about this when he said that letting go and generosity is an act of compassion for yourself, but it's also an act of compassion for all beings. What we are letting go of is not things. What we are letting go of is suffering. That's what this path is concerned with, is how to release suffering. So, and it is, as I mentioned last night, it is why so much emphasis in this teaching is given to diving deeply into ourselves to discover that inwardly generated joy and happiness and sense of sufficiency, which doesn't lean upon anything. Speaking of generosity, one lama described the torment of withholding and fear, saying, having some possessions, a person holds tight to them with a dying person's grip. No matter how much they have, still they think they have nothing and moan as if they are on the point of starvation. Such behavior can create right now an experience like those of the hungry ghost. The answer, he wrote, as a practice, reduce our cravings, learn to be content with what we have, and discover inner sufficiency. So the second dimension of generosity, so the first dimension of generosity is the material generosity. Second dimension that Shantideva speaks about is the gift of fearlessness. The gift of fearlessness. Many dimensions of this, being a refuge to those who have no place of safety, being a refuge to those who are afraid and vulnerable, giving protection to those who have no protection, being a companion to those who have no friends. It might mean taking a small creature out of harm's way, the gift of listening to another person wholeheartedly, the gift of non-judgment, the gift of kindness. The gift of fearlessness is also challenging, being able to say no to the causes of suffering, being able to say no to injustice and violence and cruelty, and being aware that the generosity of fearlessness does not always make us popular. But the gift of fearlessness is something, too, we offer to ourselves. What I think, if we look at our own experience, we see how much that aversion and fear are really the proximate causes of disconnection in our lives. When there is fear and aversion, our automatic response is to step back, to move away, to disconnect, to increase and enhance the sense of self and other. And I'm sure we can relate to this in our lives on a very moment-to-moment sense. You just feel the pushing away of aversion and fear. But there is actually too so much that we turn away from and disconnect from in ourselves, all that we condemn and dismiss and reject. And in truth, we can do this so often that we actually no longer know what it means how to protect ourselves or to be a refuge to ourselves or to be a friend of ourselves. So generosity in this sense, a generosity in the gift of fearlessness, in many ways is learning to cultivate non-abandonment. Learning to cultivate non-abandonment. Not to flee, but to befriend. I wanted to share with you a small poem I love. It really, I think, speaks to this. It says, "The old man must have stopped our car 2 dozen times to climb out and gather into his hands the small toads blinded by our lights and leaping live drops of rain. The rain was falling and mist about his white hair, and I kept saying, 'You can't save them all. Accept it. Get back in. We've got places to go.' But leathery hands full of wet brown life, knee-deep in the summer roadside grass, he just smiled and said, 'They have places to go to.'" The third dimension of generosity is the gift of the Dhamma, and I think there are many, many layers to this. Certainly its primary sense is the willingness to share the teachings of liberation. Now, this is again something to discern the difference between the intentionality of our hearts and how that gets translated in our lives. It would not be helpful to approach the cashier at the supermarket with the liberating teaching of renunciation. But we offer the gift of the Dharma very much by how we are in the world and what we are committed to. And I think that the gift or the generosity of the Dhamma is the gift of whatever words or actions or thoughts would be most liberating, most healing, most beneficial, most compassionate in the moment, whether to oneself or another. I think the gift of the Dhamma is the ongoing investigation, the ongoing exploration of what eases suffering in this world and increases respect and harmony. And again, this is too very often swimming against the tide of what I feel like, what I want, or what I feel I need. But establishing, in my sense, you know, this practice is not just about our internal world. This path is very much about how we engage with all of the world around us. And I feel like this gift of the Dharma is again establishing a foundation of relatedness and living, which is really rooted in what eases suffering rather than what perpetuates it, what brings healing and freedom from fear. And I know in my life I don't have to look very far to find the places that can be transformed by a generous heart. And it's almost every place where there's any contractedness of judgment or blaming or holding. The gift of the Dhamma for me too is about challenging the gap that can exist between our intellectual agreement with the teachings of kindness and compassion and generosity and our actual embodiment. A friend of mine refers to this as being the movement from conscious incompetence to conscious competence. You know, and conscious incompetence is kind of when we have enough mindfulness in place to know when there's a lot of unskillfulness going on in our mind and we stand there like a spectator on our own disasters. Oh, you know, I know it's not helpful to be so judgmental or withholding. Oh, but they're withholding judgment. It's a kind of conscious incompetence. It's an incredibly frustrating place to be in the path. And there isn't a shortcut around that place, I have to say. It's like we've got to hang out there for a while. But we know that we're trying to move from conscious incompetence to conscious competence, where there is this kind of this weaving together both of our intentions, what we know to be valuable, what we are committed to, and what we embody in our lives. Just to finish this piece, Ajahn Chah, in speaking about generosity, he says, the Buddha taught us to lay down those things that lack a real abiding essence. If you lay down everything, you will see the truth. If you don't, you won't. That's the way it is. And when insight awakens within you, you will see the truth wherever you look. This is all that you will see. So, going to move on to the second of the paramis. Any questions just before we put this piece down?
Yeah. I have a question about the conscious incompetence, like on the path of developing it. And I think it relates to a lot of my questions in other areas too, like because it's not a linear horizontal path, are we going to again experience that at some point further on? I mean, like, is there a point that we ultimately are always competent?
Yes, that is the point we are moving towards. I mean, did you hear the question? I mean, the path is not linear. The path is not linear. And I often frame it differently as being a kind of movement from one quality of choicelessness to a quality of wise choice, to a different dimension of choicelessness. which is kind of moving from unconscious incompetence to conscious incompetence to conscious competence. And the first level of choicelessness is often just that way of being where we just feel to be governed by impulse, habit, and reactivity, and we don't know what's going on, and we keep falling in the holes and feel bewildered and say, how did that happen, you know, and how did I end up here? And then I think there's more movement to conscious incompetence, you know, where we actually know how we ended up in that hole. You know, it's not a mystery, we're not bewildered, we know what's going on, but it's a habit. It's a habit. And, you know, much of this practice is actually swimming against the tide of habit. So we see ourselves moving in and out of that kind of governance by habit to not being so governed by habit. But there is actually, you know, what the Buddha really speaks about and what I have real confidence in this path, in this teaching, is about really uprooting those seeds of habit. And, you know, I don't want to also present that as something, you know, as some unattainable breakthrough moment that only happens to a select few. Because I suspect there's many people in this room who've practiced for quite a while who have seen things fall away that don't come back. You know, it might be doubt that falls away and it doesn't come back. It's gone. You know? But it didn't happen in a moment. It didn't happen through some magical moment of insight. It's more there's a kind of almost a osmosis that happens where something is absorbed almost onto a cellular level and it doesn't come back. And I think it's really important to hold that possibility in our attention to know it, rather than feeling that, you know, our practice or our path is always going to be one of verging between consciousness and unconsciousness. No, it's not linear, but even underneath the peaks and the valleys, there is a development that is going on.